There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, so glad you can join me as we talk some classic cardboard and some not-so-classic cardboard. But this time around, we've got some not-so-classic cardboard that is becoming a classic. And it's starting to see a little bit of love many years later. 27 years later, it took for the 93 top set to kind of get the traction that we all hoped a lot of our junk wax era cards would. And it's mostly because of one card. Yes, Jeets, with Derek Jeter getting inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame this summer. Who knows if anybody will be in the audience to watch it, but his plaque will go up in Cooperstown. With that starting up this summer, the mad market for 93 Tops, and in particular 93 Tops gold cards, is starting to heat up in a feverish pitch that I haven't seen in a while. I almost said 89 Upper Deck. I almost said Ken Griffey Jr. And an ungraded Jeter gold card isn't quite going at the rate that a Ken Griffey Jr. card number one of 89 Upper Deck is going. But you catch my drift. And we will talk a little bit about that Jeter card, the gold card, the rush that is behind it. That's why the prices of 93 Tops are much higher than a lot of other cards from around that time. And once we get past the Jeter card, there's a whole lot of things to like about 93 Tops. And if you don't mind spending a few extra dollars because of that market push with the Jeter rookie, if you don't mind spending that extra few bucks for it, it's a fun set to collect. And this is one of those sets that is getting added to my regret that I got rid of list. When I had my big purge of cards, what's been now probably 16, 17 years ago, and I sold all those boxes for a dollar a piece, 1,000-count boxes for a dollar a piece to a local card show, or a local card store, I should say. That's one that now I kind of look back and go, you know, probably should have hung on to that. Much like the 91 Bowmans, much like the 91 Tops. You know, all the other ones. 90 Donruss, whatever. 89 Fleer, adios. But yeah, 93 Tops, I'm starting to come back to it, and there's a lot of emotional reasons why, and I'll get into those as well. Now, I hope your emotions are holding up as we continue to lock down, hunker down, as we like to call it, in hurricane territory here in Florida, which is about to become a petri dish of stupidity if some people rush the reopening of Florida, if you will. But enough about politics. Regardless of where you're listening or what the situation is in your locale, I hope you're staying safe, staying healthy, and as things do eventually start opening up again, and in many places it's going to be piece by piece and region by region, I just hope that you take whatever precautions are necessary to avoid getting sick with the coronavirus. Wearing the mask, continuing with social distancing, maybe limiting some of those outdoor activities, or not necessarily outdoor, but communal activities that you used to do. There's still a chance that you'll find some kind of antibiotics or vaccines on the market within the next couple of years, but that's still a ways away. And I know there's a lot of people who are pent up, who are upset about still being in their homes, who are upset about being teachers to their kids when they didn't expect to do that as of a few weeks ago. And obviously there's a little bit of stir craziness going on. But I would like to remind people, and again, let's take politics out of it, but let's just remember the alternative to the stir craziness of locking down involves you being hooked up to a ventilator, and that's no fun. So as things start opening up over the next several weeks, as some rules get relaxed, as some people get back to work or try to get back into some normalcy, just be smart and be safe. And as I've said before, listen to the health experts, listen to the epidemiologists, listen to the people who deal with pandemics or pandemic modeling on a regular basis. Those are the people who have the health interests of the general public front and center. Everyone else, it's either an election that they're worried about, or it's a chamber of commerce that they're worried about, or it's a stock price that they're worried about. That's not you. You are not a stock price. You are not an election. You are a human being. So make sure you're getting some good information, some good advice from good resources. And hopefully we will all emerge from this stronger and still healthy and somewhat sane as spring rolls into summer. Now, as for our program, as I mentioned on the last show, despite the pandemic, we are still rolling along every 2 weeks. You will be hearing a show here every other Friday. Next podcast is scheduled for Friday, May the 8th. We'll open up the 83 Tops cello packs, talk about the 83 Tops set, and also discuss the year of the rookie card, because you have the holy trinity of rookies, as I refer to them, and Ryan Sandberg, Tony Gwynn, and Wade Boggs. But you had other rookies, most notably Ron Kittle, that was getting a lot of attention back then. There was a renewed interest in the rookie cards of other recent stars, such as Cal Ripken Jr. and Ricky Henderson and many others from the late 70s. And it really was the catalyst, the 83 season and the 83 card sets, really was the catalyst for the rookie card craze, which culminated with Don Mattingly in 1984. Shortly thereafter with a couple of 84 update sets, but then the 1985 sets with Kirby Puckett and Roger Clemens, Dwight Gooden as well, Brett Saberhagen. And then, of course, you would have Mark McGwire, the Olympic card in 1985, although most people didn't know how great he was going to be until 87 and 88 when his regular base set cards were coming out. So we'll talk a little bit about the rookie card craze and how that also started rated rookies and other rookie subsets in the mid-1980s that became very popular, and some of them are still hallmarks of the collector's world these days, not just in baseball cards, but other cards as well. Now, other future podcasts, I do have several packs of 94 tops. So at some point in time, and I'm not necessarily saying this is the one following the next show, I'm not necessarily saying it's definitely on the May 22nd show, but we will be talking about some 94 tops. As I mentioned in the last podcast, it's a very interesting year for me, a very conflicting year for me. This is the first time since 1994 I've bought any baseball cards from 1994. I still have not purchased packs of cards from 95 through, what, about 2003 or 2002, something like that. So that is something that eventually will get worked into the program, too, as I now get to explore some of those sets that I just totally forgot about, didn't want to deal with for many, many years for various reasons, which we'll get into in the 94 Tops break. And we also have the trio of Bowman cards, 91, 92, and 93. I've got a pack from each. And we'll talk about the turning point for Bowman. I love the 91 set. It's starting to, you know, gain a little traction, thanks mostly to the Chipper Jones rookie card that's in there. But also 1992, a huge leap forward for Bowman. 1993, it really cements itself as the rookie card set. And that is the flag that Bowman's been carrying ever since then. And it is a big staple in the Topps products now. If you want rookies, and not just rookies, but guys who are basically rookies in pro ball who aren't going to play in the major leagues for another 5 or 6 years, the Bowman set is definitely the one that you want. And an interesting side effect, I was actually thinking about this recently, an interesting side effect of how Bowman became not just the rookie card set, but the first pro card for a lot of players. And that is the demise of the minor league card. Remember how popular minor league cards were in the late 80s and early 90s? In particular, Pro Cards was the name brand of the cards that had AA and AAA. And then, of course, you had Classic Best. And Topps still does some minor league cards. They do a minor league version of Topps Heritage every year. But I think that's really a niche audience, not just the minor league audience, but the people who would actually like it in a heritage format. That's a really small target that Topps is aiming for. But I think that the minor league card industry, if you will, kind of hit its peak in 91, 92, 93. And I don't think it's a coincidence that when Bowman kind of took over the crown there, that minor league baseball card started falling off by the wayside. I'm sure there are other factors, which I'll dive into during that program. That's also coming up. And also, looking forward probably several weeks, I got it was a direct message from Luke Wilkinson, who is a new listener. He and his dad live in the St. Louis area, and actually, after listening to the podcast, started hand collating junk wax era sets. Luke is on the younger side of our audience, so the junk wax era, what was passe to us as teenagers, he's a little younger, and this is all new to him. But I want to thank Luke and Dad for listening and for keeping the hobby going and collecting all those junk wax era sets. And he asked me if I've ever done an episode on the 1990 Swell Baseball Greats set. And I responded to Luke, and I'll share it with everybody here, that, I haven't. And that's just one of those sets that I didn't really collect back in 1990. And also, as the case would turn out, I never really got any in any kind of variety pack of packs or cards or anything like that. So when the podcast first started and I was going, first in our monster box, going year by year and set by set, obviously I had no cards from the 1990 Swell set. Now, I don't want to dedicate an entire show to it, but what I think makes sense is somewhere in the future we'll have a show of some, and I'll call them one-off sets, even though technically they aren't one-off. But a couple of oddball sets, actually three oddball sets from the late 80s and early 90s, that Swell set that he mentioned, also the Sporting News Legends set. I got a couple packs sent in from a listener, and a listener also sent me several cards, and actually my son has a couple packs. He got them, I think, for free. They were in a bargain bin at the flea market, and the seller's like, here, just take a couple of those. Talking about the Topps Big cards from 1988. And it wasn't until it was brought to my attention by the listener who sent in, I want to say about 20 or 30 of these cards, that the Topps Big set was actually a modernized tribute to the 1956 Topps cards. And it wasn't until, not necessarily when I looked at the front, because they have a decidedly 1988 look to them, but it wasn't until I flipped them over on the back and saw the cartoons and how they were laid out and how similar they were to 56 Topps that it dawned on me. I'm like, oh yeah, this is actually a modernized 1988 style version of the classic 56 set. So we'll have a show that covers all of those little oddball sets, because those are some of those unique niche sets that you can find these days that are not exactly in a whole lot of demand. They're actually somewhat easier to find. And that actually brings me to another interesting find as we take a look at our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, which is open 24/7. Our good friend Gord Tepp tagging me in, and several other people, who remembers 1989 Topps double headers? And I had to look up the 1989 Topps double headers, and there was actually a YouTube link that Gord sent along the way. And when I looked at the link, I went, oh yeah, I had one of those. But I couldn't remember for the life of me who it was. I couldn't remember who the player was. So I'm racking my brain, and I'm thinking, all right, I know I bought one of these in 1989 or 1990, and I think it was Don Mattingly, I think. And the double headers, it was actually a very unique product that Topps made, where it was basically a mini version of the current player's card. And then if you flipped it over, it was a mini version of the player's rookie card. And meanwhile, this card was in a little plastic stand, a miniature plastic stand. So it gave it the look of a priceless relic, if you will, you know, something that had to be authenticated or whatever. And I remember having one, like I said, I'm pretty sure it was Mattingly. And clearly it made no indelible mark on my life because I got rid of it. I don't know if I sold it or just threw it out one day, but I now recall those cards. And I think the doubleheaders, while unique, I don't think that they really gathered a lot of attention or love back then because they were kind of kitschy. And I'm sure for Topps, it was expensive to make because you had to make this high quality, kind of glossy looking card for this piece of plastic. It was probably very expensive and not really worth the investment considering hobbyists didn't really collect them en masse. And then, of course, you know, 1989, we're talking about the introduction of Upper Deck and, you know, the reintroduction of Bowman. And now you've got five companies making base sets as opposed to three or just 9 years before one. So I think the market was starting to get flooded a little bit and people were more interested in checking out the new base sets as opposed to finding this, kitschy little knickknack kind of set. But they were kind of neat, and I may go searching around to see if somebody's got them because I don't think they're valued very highly, and you can probably find somebody who's just clearing out, you know, maybe a shoebox of them in their house for a buck a piece or something. But I do thank you, Gord, for sending that because it did jog the memory a little bit, and I do recall those particular cards, and I recall having one. I don't know who it was. I think it was Mattingly, and I think it just ended up in my trash can. So that's just how incredible the Topps doubleheader cards were back in 1989. Another listener tuning in here, it's Brian, who has a great handle here, 2016 Bucket to Junk. And he writes me, I just found your podcast about 2 weeks ago, and I'm trying to catch up on all the archives. What an amazing show. I'll give you a 5-star review. Well, thank you very much, Brian. When the economy picks up, I'll give a donation. All right, well, thoughts on both of those in a moment. But Brian, thank you so much for finding the podcast and for listening as well and for sharing your comments too. And I'm glad you could find it. And the good thing is, with all of this lockdown time, we've got plenty of time to look back at the archives. We've got plenty of time to go back and go through our own card collections and dig around and see what we've got, what's been hiding in our storage boxes and folders and, in stacks on bookshelves for all these years. And hopefully that's at least providing some kind of levity and some kind of entertainment right now. Again, eventually things will start slowly opening up and we can slowly try to piece things together and try to add to our lives outside of our living confinement. But until then, have some fun with the hobby. And I'll be honest with you, I am so glad that I have not only a hobby in terms of sports card collections, even though it's a fraction of what I used to have when I was a kid. And I am so glad that I read a ton of books. I am so glad that, you know, I've got two kids and, you know, two cats and a wife, you know, to keep everybody sane and entertained and everything. But my point is, I'm so glad that there is more to my life than just sports. And as big of a sports fan as I am, and as much of my life and career have evolved around or revolved around sports, I am so glad in this time where sports is not happening. And I'll be honest, folks, sports will be the last thing to be normalized because of this. It's going to be a while before we approach any kind of safe normalcy to attending sporting events, to watching them on TV, just to even getting them off the ground. As I speak, all the professional sports leagues are still on hold and likely will be for the next several weeks. And it's a huge impact, not only on our economy, but our sanity as well, because we're so used to getting away from the garbage in life and by turning on the tube or going to a ballpark and watching a game. But I am so glad that I've got more than sports to rely on. And I think a lot of people are discovering, hey, I need to find a hobby. I need to do something other than sports, because even though sports was always supposed to be there for us, well, guess what? It's been taken away, and it's going to be away from us for a while, and it's going to be an even longer while before we can approach sports, watching it in person or on television or listening to it on the radio in any kind of normal fashion prior to the coronavirus, striking the world. So I'm really glad that I've got these kind of mini distractions to keep me going. And boy, if you haven't watched everything on Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu, you know, whatever streaming device you've got, you've certainly caught up on your favorite TV shows and maybe some movies you haven't watched in a while. But if you are a collector, be thankful that you're a collector and you've got something to, you know, divert your attention, even if it's just for an hour, just thumbing through an old, binder, or, you know, a couple of hours on a rainy day going through a box of cards. I'm already looking through, this is so funny, 93 top stadium clubs. So several months ago, we did an episode on 93 top stadium club. And it just so happened, it was series one, stadium club that year was broken up into three series. And I had a box of series one, we did a show about it. And after I opened up all the packs, I realized, hey, I actually have the entire first series, all 330 cards. Didn't have a lot of dupes. I only had about 20 or 30 dupes to pass off into our Commons for Kids donation. So I got this idea. I'm like, you know what, just for personal reasons, I'm going to open up this box of series two that I have. I figured it wasn't worth doing a show over. But I opened up the box of series two, just got bored a couple months ago and went, oh, what the hell, might as well. Well, of course, that box, I wasn't so fortunate. I had something like 36 cards that I needed to complete the next series of 330 cards. So as I'm realizing this, as I'm sorting them, I'm just like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Because it was just one of those sets that I embarked on, just on a lark. And then I'm like, oh, crap. I got to buy these cards. And, you know, I was lucky. I got these two Series 1 and Series 2 boxes at the local card show for like $6 a pop. So, you know, I'm like, all right. So I did a call out to our listeners. And thankfully, we had one listener who had all but one. The one card I was missing is a Greg Myers card, which I actually recently just purchased on eBay. And let me tell you, I never in my life thought I'd spend $3. That's 99 cents plus shipping and handling. I never thought I'd spend $3 on a Greg Myers baseball card. But that'll be arriving soon. So Series 2 is coming. And I recently found a good deal on a jumbo box of Series 3. And that arrived in the mail yesterday. And I just went, well, I've got something for the next rainy day. And per the forecast, it's going to be this weekend here where I live. So again, for those of us who are collectors, we've got something. Sure, we miss our sports. We love our sports. We want to go back to live sports. But you've got this and everything else you've got, whether it's books or a good TV series you're watching, family, friends, a swimming pool in your backyard and you live in a warm climate. Take those as blessings during this very tough time here. I think you'll really appreciate some of the little things that you have in life where something so big as, you know, kind of dictating your calendar and life around sports is not so big. So that is Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed open 24/7. Now, as we were mentioning in that tweet from our newfound listener, Brian, a couple of things. One is donations. I've been doing a soft sell on the donations. I normally hit it a little harder, but I know that a lot of people are in a very tough condition financially speaking, so I'll just throw the mention out there. If you want to make a donation to help keep the Wax Ecstatic Podcast alive and well. You can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. That's all one word there, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And any donation, whether it's just a few bucks or a little more, always helps us in a couple of ways. One, helping us keep our podcast and the RSS feed alive and well at our home base on Audioboom, but also it helps us buy the product that we discuss here. So all these 93 tops packs, the Bowman packs I was telling you about, the 83 tops packs have been sitting in a closet for a couple of years. Those were all bought with funds that were contributed through donations. So that helps out tremendously. It also helps us keep the archives free and open to everybody. We've never had to put them behind a paywall, which is, especially during these times, good. Because you can entertain yourself with well over 150 episodes from the last several years. So, again, it's a soft sell. Everyone's financial situation is different, and most everybody's is in a bad spot right now and will be for the next few months. So if you've got it, want to donate, great. If not, don't sweat it. Don't worry about it. The time will come when you can do that. And I do thank you at least for thinking about the program too. And remember that the dollars that come in go right to the program. This doesn't go to me paying my power bill or feeding my kids or anything. This is something that goes right back into the program. And as I've also mentioned, any excess product that we have that we open up on the show, it goes to Commons for Kids, which is just still collecting hundreds of thousands of baseball, football, hockey, basketball, non-sports cards as well. And they are donating to the kids who have a little trouble making ends meet, or their families have trouble making ends meet. And we all know that baseball cards are not as cheap these days as they were when we were kids. So to help put cards in kids' hands, to help keep them connected to the sport and to the hobby, that's what Commons for Kids does. And they also make donations to hospitals, charity groups, kids who are dealing with medical issues, kids who are hospitalized, kids who may be in a foster care system, kids who have just a lot of crap to deal with. Nothing lifts them up more than giving them the gift of a package of cards, or maybe a group of cards of their favorite player, or their favorite team. So it's all part of Commons for Kids, so gladly donate to them once we are able to cobble together a couple thousand extra cards. And I do believe we're starting to get to that point. We'll probably be making another shipment out within the next month or so. So keep that in mind, too, with any donations that you make. Likewise, if you do a trade with me, or you want to donate some cards to me, I mean, make sure you ask me first to make sure that I can use them in the show. But if we have any extra cards from those donations, those also go to Commons for Kids as well. So don't feel bad if you can't make any kind of donation in any form or fashion. It's okay. We're all feeling the pinch a little bit. And I also want to clarify something too. We've had some wonderful donations coming, cash donations, and I appreciate the listeners who have done that. But I want to stress, even though I've said, and I'm still in the situation where, because all of my work is involving sports and there's no sports, so I've got $0 in revenue coming in, no income coming in my personal bank account. I'm not living on the street. You know, we're not destitute. The family is actually doing okay, and we're going to be fine for a little while. So while I do appreciate the donations that have been made, I just want to stress that this is not the Oral Roberts, give me money or God's going to take me kind of challenge, okay? So if you're going to make a donation because you got 5 spare bucks or 10 spare bucks and you want to donate to the program, not because you feel bad for me, because I, as well as, I don't know, what, 30 million Americans are sitting on our hands waiting for some work to come. So that's not it. It's not a plea for me or anything else. I was trying to bring myself to the same level as many of our listeners, that right now your hours are reduced, or your jobs have been eliminated, or you were already unemployed and waiting in the unemployment line is much harder nowadays because everybody else is doing it. I totally feel your pain. I completely understand where you're coming from. And that's why I've said, if you can't make a donation, don't worry about it. It's okay. I know where you're coming from. It's all good. By the way, reviews, which Brian brought up as well. Yes, we do appreciate reviews. If you love the show as much as Brian does, certainly a 5-star review is great. Whatever the platform is, whether it's on Apple Podcast or any of the other subsidiaries that send out our podcast, be it iHeartRadio or TuneIn or Spotify or Google Play, however you listen, or if you're listening through Audio Boom. If you have the opportunity to rate and review the podcast, please do. Please be honest. And when you do that, especially if you give it a 4 or 5 star rating, the better the ratings, the better the commentary. It bumps us up in the algorithm that sends people notices on, hey, you may like this. So if somebody else is listening to a podcast that's about sports or about card collecting or hobbies and stuff like that, the more positive reviews we get, the more the word about Wax Ecstatic gets out just through the algorithms of Apple Podcasts and everybody else. It just kind of gets bumped up in the suggestion list. So Brian, again, welcome to the program. Appreciate you listening. Thank you for your kind comments and for touching on a couple of housekeeping points as well. All right, let's dive into the 1993 top set. It's a wonderful set, and it was back then, and because it got swallowed up in kind of the quote-unquote junk wax era terminology, a lot of people tend to overlook it. But again, thanks to Derek Jeter, as well as a pretty good crop of some young ball players, including Pedro Martinez, and then, of course, you've got Frank Thomas and Ken Griffey Jr., and Mike Piazza had a rookie card that year as well. Yeah, because of a lot of quality players that were playing in the major leagues at that time, 93 Tops has been resuscitated a little bit over the last few years, as well as our usual bout of 90s nostalgia, which is alive and well these days. Boy, whenever you're dealing with any kind of hard times, people just love throwing it back to the good old days, back when things were simple. And, you know, you can sing the All in the Family theme song to this. You know, people like to forget about today's problems by just throwing it back about 20 or so years. And even though 20 years ago is 2000, we still have a lot of nostalgia for the 90s. And you've got star power, you've got some key rookie cards, and you've got people that are looking back at some of those sets from 25 or so years ago going, this ain't so bad, let's go get it. And 93 Tops is a very interesting divide in the set. First of all, let's talk about the design of the cards here. Big step forward for Tops in 1993, which really started in 1992. Of course, in 1991, Topps put out a great set. I've called it the last fun baseball card because that was the last year that you still had great card stock. You still had 792 cards, no frills, bubblegum stick in there, and that was about it. Now, because 1991 was the 40th anniversary of Topps, you had the old cards that were put into some of the packs, randomly inserted, and you also had the cards that you could obtain. You know, if you got the redemption slips, you could send it in for a 65 mantle or, you know, whatever they were giving away. So you had that kind of added hook in 1991. Well, by 1992, as the premium sets were starting to make the base sets look a little outdated, Topps had to take a step forward. So they did so by changing to white card stock, adding the Topps gold cards as an incentive to buy the packs, having the winner edition of Topps gold cards. So if you didn't win anything on the scratch-off cards inside the packs, then you could send off like 20 of them, I think. You sent them off to Topps in the mail, and you got a pack of 10 or 8 or however many winner gold cards. And you also had the introduction of photographs on the back of Topps cards, color photographs. First time we've had full color photographs on the back of Topps cards. And as opposed to Upper Deck or Score, which did it first in 1988, then you had the stadiums that were featured on the back of 92 Topps, which is a little odd, but nowadays it's a neat look back at what were then current stadiums. So if you wanted to wonder why people were so down on stadiums like Riverfront Stadium and Three Rivers Stadium and the Old Busch Stadium and Fulton County Stadium, you could see how they were all similar. You could see how La Stade Olympique in Montreal looked like a big alien spacecraft. You could look at the dulcet tones of the Astrodome at night, or was it day? Who knows? There was a roof on top. So it's a neat little trip back to some of the old ballparks. But it's rather odd that instead of going with the players or action shots like Upper Deck was doing by this point in time, they were going with the stadiums. Well, Topps decides to take everything an even bigger step forward in 1993. First of all, the photos that are featured on the back are full-colored in normal cases, action shots of players as well. You had lots of color on the cards. You flip it over to the front, you've got, in most cases, action shots, at least nice, vibrant, full-color photographs there. Topps was starting to yield the space to more photo space as opposed to design elements. It's a very simple, clean design. You do have a white border, yes, but when you look at things like player name and team name and position, stuff like that, there's not a whole lot. There's the player's name, there's the team's name, there's a position, but there's no logo. In fact, even on the backs of the cards, there's no logo. So very, very simple look to the Topps cards. And then on top of that, you had an improved card stock. So they had already switched to the white card stock. Well, this one was a little bit thicker than 1992. It also had a little bit of a glossy look to it. And on top of all of this, you not only had the Topps Gold Series, which came back, and of course, Topps loved the gold cards to where in 92, they were randomly inserting these. You averaged, I think, one gold card per box. Well, now you had one gold card per pack. And you had the black gold card. That's right, Texas Tea. Actually, many 93 Topps black gold cards selling more than a barrel of crude these days, but I digress. The black gold cards had a little more of a premium to them. They were a subset, the ones that featured individual players, and it had 44 total cards. So you could get a randomly inserted black gold card like we did in our video break. You should check it out. Go to YouTube if you haven't already. Wax Ecstatic 1993 Topps Series 1 Pack Break. One of the five packs I opened up had a Gary Sheffield black gold card. And compared to a lot of the inserts that card companies were putting in back then, the black gold card was actually really sharp. The black onyx, you know, the matte color lined up next to the gold, that sparkly gold foil look, has a nice contrast to it, really pops off of that glossy white cardstock as well. And there's actually some value to some of those black gold cards as opposed to some of the other inserts that have been put in over the years. And I recall you could get a redemption card. I think I still have a couple of redemption black gold cards. Of course, they're expired. I can't send them to Topps and get these cards. But you had the redemption cards that showcased 11 of the 44 cards that you could get in this subset. So you have a quality card in terms of just how it's made. You've got a quality card in terms of how it's designed. You've got a quality insert with the gold card in every pack and the chance to get a black gold card. And for the first time since 1973, Topps split up the base set. And they kind of had to. Because of the introduction of the Florida Marlins and the Colorado Rockies in 1993, you had to have new cards for most of those players with their teams. Of course, you couldn't do the full 25-man roster, but at least you could pick 15 to 20 of the players who were on the expansion draft, players that you were pretty certain were A, going to remain with their teams, and B, were going to at least play in the major leagues for a few more years, and they weren't just those 4A players that kind of popped in and out of the major leagues. So Topps grew the base set from the traditional 792, and I say traditional just because it was at 792 for many, many years. They grew it to 825 cards. They split the set into two series, but not right down the middle. You would think they would go up 412 or 413. No, there's 396 cards in Series 1, and then you've got the remaining balance in Series 2. Now, why the lopsided size? Well, Series 2 features the Marlins and Rockies players in their uniforms. And that was something that Topps didn't have the luxury of having back in all previous expansions. The most recent one before 1993 was 1977. And we've discussed that, how with the expansion of the Blue Jays and the Mariners, plus the dawn of free agency, where there were, because of this expansion of free agency, quite literally a couple of hundred players were playing for new or different teams in 1977, the Topps artists had to basically take nearly a quarter of their set, and they had to airbrush the cards. So Topps didn't have the luxury of waiting a couple of months to get pictures of players in spring training in their new uniform, but they did that in 1993. So the second series is a little more heavily weighted than the first series, but if you were a fan of the Marlins or Rockies, or you just wanted to see these players with their new teams and their new uniforms, a lot of those pictures taken in spring training, you got them all in Series 2, which, if memory serves correct, was released in, I want to say, late May of 93. So kind of, late spring it came out. You didn't have to wait too long, but that way you could collect the entire set by the time summer vacation rolled around. And remember, 1993, this is the very, very, very early days of the internet making any kind of impact in America. Really wouldn't make full impact until, I'd say, around 1996, 1997, somewhere around there. So unless you saw Marlins or Rockies highlights in person, on SportsCenter, or pictures of these players in the Sporting News or Sports Illustrated or your local newspaper, this was the best way to see in full color the new teams and their players in their new uniforms. So it was a must for Topps to kind of hold on to that until Series 2 to feature some of the more well-known players in both of those teams. Now, I've talked about some of the big rookie cards, and we'll talk about the biggest in a moment. But one interesting rookie card that is in the 93 series is Florida Marlins reliever Trevor Hoffman, of course, would go on to much more fame with the San Diego Padres. But yes, Trevor Hoffman was a member of the Marlins before he went to San Diego in an ill-fated deal. So that's a unique card that you can get in Series 2. Now, Series 2 is actually very easy to get a hold of. You can find packs, you can find boxes, you can find vending boxes, and they're going at about the rate that you would expect for most junk wax era cards. Vending boxes, $8 to $10 a pop. Wax boxes, or even jumbo packs, those boxes going for, $15 to $20 a box, depending on where you get them. Individual packs, 50 cents, a dollar, something like that. But Series 1 is a completely different story. As I found out while I was shopping for some Series 1 packs, it is all because of Derek Jeter, and not only the Derek Jeter rookie card, but the chance of landing a gold Derek Jeter rookie card that has driven the prices of Series 1 93 Topps cards, I won't say through the roof, but certainly much higher than most cards that were released in 1993. Now, you think of some of the sets from 1993. You had Fleer Ultra, you had Leaf Studio, you had Upper Deck, you had Stadium Club. You had some pretty decent sets that were put out during this time. But the top set, even though the base set was really good and had a lot of elements from the early 1970s, in fact, in many ways, it was like the 1971 top set. And while there was a good crop of young stars and rookies and great inserts as well, compared to some of the other sets that were being made in 1993, Topps was actually a fairly average, I'll say above average, but certainly at the time didn't quite match up to some of the competition. But thanks to the longevity of one of the rookie players in that set, and the chance that you could get a gold card, which in many ways is a variation of a base card, let's just call it that, that has driven up the prices quite a bit. Much like the chance that you can still get a Reggie Jackson autograph card or a Nolan Ryan autograph card in some of the early 90s Upper Deck packs. That possibility is still out there. So the Derek Jeter rookie card, and more importantly, the gold Derek Jeter rookie card, is keeping the 93 Topps Series 1 set alive and certainly will. I've seen individual packs, depending on if you're buying one or if you're getting a lot of them, are going for about $4 to $6 a piece. Wax boxes, depending on where you get it and shipping costs, anywhere from $60 to $100. The same thing with the vending boxes. You know, we did a show about how vending boxes were affordable ways of adding to your collection. Not so if you're buying 93 Tops Series 1. I saw vending boxes on eBay, much like the wax boxes, going anywhere from $60 to $100, whether it was a buy it now price or at an auction, and there was some feverish bidding. And why not? The gold card is selling at a premium, selling at much higher than many other cards from that particular era. I am fortunate, and I showed this in the video, I am fortunate to be the holder of one of those cards.
For sale, if the price is right.
And it is a card that I actually pulled back in 1993. I very wisely, you know, I had no idea who Derek Jeter was, but I very wisely took that card and put it in a plastic folder or a plastic binder page, you know what I mean? And several years ago, extracted it very carefully from that plastic binder and put it in a lockdown holder. Now, I also have the regular Jeter rookie card. That's one because it is kind of plentiful. You know, it is 1993, so there's still a lot of the cards out there. That's valued at a few bucks. You know, an ungraded card you can get for, you know, a few dollars. However, I've seen if you go on eBay, you'll see people that have 20 of them, and they'll sell you a lot of 20 ungraded Derek Jeter rookie cards for 20 bucks or 30 bucks. But it's that gold card, and in particular the graded gold card, that is really getting a premium. At last check, PSA 9 Jeter gold rookie, which by the naked eye I'm thinking mine is $125. A PSA 10, and there's actually a pretty good size population of these, going for over $1,100 a card. And that is all because he is going to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in a couple of months from now, when he is actually in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And that's, you know, assuming that the ceremonies will still happen in the summer when they do. But once Jeter is actually in the Hall of Fame, you can expect the price to go up even more. Now, can you pay down your mortgage with it? Probably not. But if you're the holder of one of those gold Jeter rookie cards, might be worth getting it graded. I'm one of the few people that, you know, I don't jump to grade everything, but I'm looking at this card and I'm going, I might want to send that in. I'll eventually get around to it. So that's the one card that is driving up the prices. So this is kind of the yin and the yang about the 93 Tops set. While the 93 Tops set features a lot of really cool things, new cards for the Rockies and Marlins, new cards or new card stock, new simple design, really good design, good set, young players, good rookie cards, the uniqueness of having to split the set again for the first time in almost 20 years, or actually exactly 20 years at that time. And, you know, on top of that, just, you know, a really good set to collect. While you've got all of that, and, you know, the pictures on the back and the black gold inserts as well. So that's the good part. The bad part is, as opposed to a lot of junk wax era sets, if you want to collect the whole thing, be prepared to put out a lot more money to cover Series 1. Series 2, you know, those vending boxes, like I said, I was kind of scouting around. I found somebody who was selling Series 2 vending boxes. I could get two for 10 bucks, and then, you know, with shipping, it's like $25 total, which isn't bad. So if I wanted to complete this set, it's relatively easy to find Series 2. But you're going to be chasing Series 1 just a little bit simply because of all of the hoopla surrounding the Derek Jeter rookie card. Now, it's still worth it if you put in the time and the money to do this. I've seen factory sets selling for about $35. Now, that, of course, doesn't include the the gold Derek Jeter. At least it shouldn't. The factory sets featured the 825 cards, including the regular Jeter, but also a number of gold cards, as well as several preview cards of the 1994 set. So maybe you luck out and you pull a gold Jeter from the factory set, but the likelihood of that is very low, simply because Topps had 824 other cards from the set to give you a gold parallel for. So, you know, the factory sets are selling for $35, $40 from what I've seen, or they've been valued at that. And a hand-collated set could go for about that much, and that's certainly twice, sometimes three times more than what you could get for any other set from around that time, especially hand-collated. So if you want to put in the time and a few dollars and the effort to build this monstrous set for Topps, it could be worth your while. But certainly do it if you just love putting together nice sets, and 93 Topps is one of those nice sets. And I mentioned before, and I'll discuss this really briefly, you know, I have an emotional attachment to 93 Topps too, because 1993, that season, was like the last season, the last summer, that I was all in on baseball cards and baseball in particular and sports. I mean, I always liked sports, but that was like the last summer of everything, you know. For me, I was in between, let's see, 93, I was in between my sophomore and junior year in high school. I was 15 going on 16. I had already amassed a collection of about 40,000 cards. It would top 50 by 1993. So, I mean, I spent so much money, so much lawn mowing money on baseball cards. And in fact, and I've told this story before, I remember in the summer of 93, I spent a lot of my lawn mowing money going to the local card shop and buying cello boxes of 87 Topps and putting together sets of that, because I got them for $20 a pop back then. And it's kind of about what they're going for now in many cases. But anyways, you know, I just remember spending a lot of time with my cards, whether it was buying them or organizing them. I also remember back then, 93 was a year that, because I was able to get more money with little odd jobs here and there, when I spent it on baseball cards, I would go out and spend it on older cards too. So that's when I started buying some older packs. I started buying lots of cards from the 60s and 70s, and doing that beyond baseball. I would buy boxes of just, you know, common football and hockey cards from the 1970s as well. So I was really expanding my horizons. The summer of 93 was a fun baseball season. I was a Blue Jays fan, so you're defending the title. Of course, they would eventually go on to win it again that October. So a lot of just fun memories. Not to say that life was easy when you're 15, but just a lot of really fun memories when I look back and think about 1993, and especially all the cards that I was buying then. I also recall on a summer vacation, our family used to go to Madeira Beach, which is, you know, not that far from where I live now, but along the Gulf Coast. And there used to be a small baseball card shop. Now you can't find a baseball card shop within 20 miles of Madeira Beach. But back then there was a small baseball card shop there. And, you know, my dad would drive me and my younger brother out there, and we would buy cards. And I remember through my lawn mowing, and I remember my family having a garage sale, in which I made my first successful sale of a hand-collated set. You know, I talked a woman into spending $15 on a hand-collated 87 top set because she was helping her son, you know, get into the hobby. I remember the money that I made off that. You know, here I am, I'm 15 years old, and I brought like $100, something like $100 or $120 to summer vacation with me. And I was so proud of myself because I worked really hard to make all that money. And I didn't blow it all on vacation, spent quite a bit of it. But I just remember buying several boxes of cards from this particular card shop. And, you know, when I wasn't out at the beach or swimming in the pool or, you know, playing pool or shuffleboard or whatever else was available at this hotel, I just remember sitting inside, you know, it was a big, it wasn't just standard hotel, it was kind of one of those apartment efficiency hotels. I just remember sitting inside the living room and just opening up box and box and box of cards and, you know, just having a blast. So that will pale in comparison to 1994. We'll get to that episode in the future, but, you know, you're still kind of, I don't want to say innocent, certainly wasn't innocent when I was 15, but when that summer, you know, what was important to me in 1993, and then you go to the summer of 1994 where you have the baseball strike, And you also have, you know, just kind of this malaise in sports because at the same time you had a hockey strike going on as well. And also I'm 16 and I'm going from my junior year to my senior year. So I'm looking forward to college. I'm, you know, doing stuff that's more important to me, graduating high school. And of course you've got the dreaded 3 G's of teenage manhood. That's right. Greenbacks, gasoline, and girls. Yeah, you know, you're buying a car, you're trying to keep it working, you're, you know, putting more of that money that you earn from odd jobs into your pocket so that you can hang out with your friends. And if you're lucky, snag the girl that you like and take her out on a date. So, you know, it's, talk about yin and yang. It was completely different, summer of 93 to, say, the summer of 94. But 93, a lot of positive memories for me, and that's why when I look back at the top set, I think so fondly to it. Because I remember, too, when that set first came out in January of 93, buying, I think, a box as soon as I could and ripping open them. And again, thankfully, fortunately, taking that gold Jeter card and putting it into a protective plastic page. Now, as we like to do near the end of each podcast, I like to pull some cards from the packs that we open up. And normally I talk about four players because it seems like we tend to open up four packs, but I had five packs. So I picked five players, one from each pack. And it's actually good that I picked five because a couple of these players, there's not a whole lot of news around them to talk about. And that includes the first one. Basically, I picked this player out of one of the packs just because the name jumped out at me. It was a fun name. I can only imagine what the Chris Berman nickname would be for Scott Scudder. Yes, Scott Scudder, just one of those, you know, it has the alliteration factor to it. Scudder sounds either like, you know, like a military missile nickname, or it sounds like something kind of dirty. Like, get your mind out of the scudder. But Scott Scudder is one of those guys who actually had a halfway decent short career in the big leagues, but he actually has a championship ring. He actually has a little bit of story to him. Scott Scudder, who is a native of Paris, Texas, was drafted by the Cincinnati Reds in the first round of the 1986 draft, and he would make his major league debut a few years later, June 6th, 1989, and had three pretty good seasons with the Reds, including the World Championship season in 1990 when the Reds swept the Oakland Athletics. And Scott Scudder had a couple of bright moments in both the National League Championship Series against the Pirates and the World Series against the A's, where he had some scoreless innings that he pitched. After three seasons in Cincinnati, he had a couple of years with the Cleveland Indians. His final game would be May 22nd of 1993. Now, his career stats don't really stand out. He had a 21-34 record, a 4.80 earned run average, and 226 strikeouts. But like I said, he's a member of not only a championship team, he said confidently, but also the last championship team for Cincinnati. It's been a while since the Reds have been in the winner's circle now, 30 years and counting, and that is something that you certainly, you know, put a little check mark on your resume. Now, he also, while he was in the minor leagues in May of 1988, pitched a no-hitter for the Cedar Rapids Reds against the Wausau Timbers. And after his playing career, he got into coaching. He was actually a coach along with former pitcher Dennis Cook of Team Sweden in the World Baseball Classic in 2010. And when he was done with that international experience, he went back home to Texas, where he is currently, and I actually looked up his LinkedIn bio, he's currently working in San Antonio as a salesman for a wood recycling business. So even though his major league career was relatively short, certainly noteworthy, that minor league no-hitter, as well as being a world champion with the Reds in 1990. Now, another former Red, he wasn't with the 1990 team, but he is better known for his time in San Diego, in which there was plenty of it. From one of the packs, we pulled out Leon Roberts, although you know Leon better as Bip. Yes, the Bipster, Bip Roberts. How did he get the nickname Bip? Well, allegedly, when he was a toddler, he had some trouble enunciating certain words. A lot of young kids do. But apparently when he was at the dinner table and he wanted to eat some more food, instead of saying, "I would like a bit more," he would say, "I would like a bip more." So somehow, through family, the Bip nickname was able to stand the test of time, and he was known as Bip Roberts throughout much of his professional career, and even well after it, too. Now, if Tony Gwynn was Mr. Padre, then Bip Roberts was likely the Mr. Roper of the Padres. He just could not stay away from the Padres, as he had three different tours of duty with the Padres. First in 1986 as a Rule 5 draft acquisition, as Bip was originally drafted in the first round of the 1982 draft by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And even though he was standing out in the minor leagues, for whatever reason, the Pirates decided to leave him exposed in the Rule 5 draft and add him to the 40-man roster. So the Padres pick him up in December 1985, and they have to keep him on the 40-man roster, and in fact on the active player roster, the 25-man roster in 1986. And he rewards the Padres with a pretty solid season. He was successful in 14 of 26 stolen base attempts, served as a pinch hitter. Padres were a decent team, so he had a pretty good experience there. But after the 86 season, the Padres decided to send him down to AAA for a little bit of seasoning, and it certainly paid off well there, as he hit 306 in 1987 and would go on to hit 353 in 1988. He would be called back up to San Diego at the end of the 1988 season, and by 1989, where he was hitting 301, he was the ultimate utility guy. You could platoon him, you could start him, you could use him as a pinch defensive replacement, certainly a pinch runner. He was very speedy. He could play pretty much every infield position but first base. He also played in the outfield as well. And despite his versatility, he did tend to be a little injury prone. So he was limited to just a little bit less than a full season in 1991, 117 games. Still, despite the injuries, managed to hit 281 that season with 26 stolen bases. But the Padres decide to move on. Of course, they acquired Tony Fernandez and Fred McGriff shortly before the 1991 season. So a guy who was injury plagued, such as Bip Roberts, was expendable. They send him to Cincinnati in exchange for Randy Myers, who of course is part of that 1990 World Series team. Now in 1992, Roberts would be named to the National League All-Star team. Ironically, a game played in Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego. And he went 2-for-2 with two RBIs in that game. He was also the Reds team MVP that season. He hit 323, stole 44 bases, and he tied a National League record in 1992 with 10 consecutive base hits. Now, again, he was dealing with injuries. He played only 83 games in the 1993 season. He would go back to San Diego, where he was re-signing with the Padres then, and again became a fan favorite there. He had an incredible strike-shortened 1994 season, including a 24-game hitting streak, hit 324 that partial season with over 20 steals. And if you want to know who broke up Pedro Martinez's 10th inning perfect game, Pedro, of course, with the Montreal Expos at the time, you guessed it, it is Bip Roberts. Now, he would, again, because of an injury-shortened 1995 season, not play the whole season. However, still batted 304. But after the 95 season concluded, the Padres sent him to Kansas City for veteran first baseman Wally Joyner. Didn't do so well in the American League, had a little trouble adjusting to everything there, and was also dealing with injuries and also was slowing down with age. So in the middle of the 1997 season, he was traded to the Cleveland Indians. Prior to 1998, signs with the Detroit Tigers before eventually getting moved to the Oakland Athletics. And despite the age, despite the injuries, despite slowing down, despite all of the movement, he was still a pretty dependable player offensively and defensively. Now, his career would end after the 1998 season, but still 12 seasons in the big leagues, a career batting average of .294. Wasn't known for his power, but still managed to get 30 home runs in his career and had 264 stolen bases. Now, afterwards, like many former ball players, Bip Roberts got into coaching. He was the head coach for Skyline High School in Oakland, California, and he is also the assistant coach to the Academy of Arts Urban Knights Division II Pac West baseball program several years back. And also, like many players, he went from the playing field to the coaching to the broadcast booth, as he is a co-host for the Oakland Athletics pregame telecast. In fact, he is currently still with the A's on Comcast Sports Network Bay Area. And that was actually pretty neat that he was able to transition so well from a productive playing career to the coaching box into the broadcast booth as well. So Bip Roberts, one of those super utility guys that gets overlooked, first of all, because he did play in San Diego for so many years, and a lot of players, they just get overlooked just because it's San Diego. You know, it's not New York, it's not Chicago, it's not Los Angeles. But a guy who was able to steal some bases, get on base quite regularly as well, and play virtually any position. Plus, speaking of great names, while Scott Scudder just comes cutting right out of your mouth, Bip Roberts is one of those great names. And he also has a great baseball card. I believe it was the 96 score set. Bip Roberts wearing a rather festive sombrero, and that goes down as one of the most interesting baseball card photos in the history of baseball cards. Now, speaking of great names, how about Angelo Cianfrocco? Well, much like Leon Roberts, you don't know Leon Roberts, you know Bip Roberts. Well, you don't know Angelo Dominic Cianfrocco, you know him as Archie. It's Archie's gang, Archie Cianfrocco, who played seven seasons in the big leagues, mostly with the Montreal Expos and San Diego Padres. In fact, he was a teammate of Bip Roberts for a couple of seasons. Also played in Japan. We'll get to that in just a moment. Now, Archie Cianfrocco was a star baseball player at Purdue, originally drafted by the Pirates in 1986 in the 11th round. He decided to not go to the Pirates. He decided to start his collegiate career at Purdue. But in the 1987 draft, he's selected in the fifth round by the Expos, and he signs with Montreal in 1987. Pretty much a utility guy as well. First base, third base, could play the corners, not known for his power, but a pretty dependable player offensively and defensively, not quite to the tune of Bip Roberts. However, after playing a couple seasons in Montreal, 1992 and 1993, he was traded to San Diego for pitcher Tim Scott, and then Archie would have a pretty big fan impact in San Diego. As the Padres were rebuilding in the mid-1990s, he had Archie's Army, also a fan club called the Cianfrocco Crew, there we go. And at the Hall of Fame weekend game in August of 1997, Archie Cianfrocco, of all people, won the home run derby, believe it or not. He is also part of a rather gruesome highlight reel footage of Tom Browning, as Browning broke his arm while delivering a pitch. It was Cianfrocco, who was then with the Padres, who was the batter during that rather gruesome play. Now, he was released by the Padres after their 1998 National League Championship season, and he played one season in Japan with the Cebu Lions. Now, he is currently living in San Diego and is an OEM sales manager at Seagate Systems. Now, a couple of the cards that I pulled from the last two packs were pitchers who were big prospects at the time, and for whatever reason didn't make it. One was Big Ben McDonald. I'm going to save him for last because there's an interesting sub-story to Ben McDonald. But then you've got a very interesting player from the Seattle Mariners, Dave Fleming. Now, Dave Fleming makes up one of three players that I can think of who were big prospect pitchers at the time but didn't make it. So I mentioned McDonald. You've got Fleming. Also, Cal Eldred of the Milwaukee Brewers. Someday we'll talk about Cal Eldred, but let's talk a little bit about Dave Fleming, native of Jackson Heights, New York, a lefty who was drafted by the Seattle Mariners in the 1990 draft in the third round. Now, he was pitching for the University of Georgia at the time, helped lead them to a College World Series title in 1990. In his rookie season in 1992, he won a career high 17 games, including 9 in a row. He had a 3.39 earned run average that year, finished third place in the American League Rookie of the Year voting. So you can imagine pulling this Dave Fleming card from a pack of 93 tops. You're like, hey, we've got a pretty good young prospect pitcher here. All right, I've got one of those cards. Well, if you hung on to your Dave Fleming cards, unfortunately, they didn't quite mature as well as the Derek Jeter cards. After going 29-15 in his first two major league seasons, Fleming had some arm trouble and eventually in July of 1995 traded to the Kansas City Royals for Bob Milwaukee. He pitched only 9 games for the Royals before undergoing arm surgery and would never pitch in the major leagues again. Now, here's the interesting story about Dave Fleming, and I love this about some of those where are they now players. Dave Fleming has been an elementary school teacher for many, many years after his playing days. His latest school is in Chatfield-Lopresti School in Seymour, Connecticut, and he is a fifth grade teacher. And I found some articles about him teaching math, you know, bringing kids to a minor league game, the New Britain Rocks games, or the Rock Cats, I think they were called. And, you know, learning math and learning statistics through baseball games, which is very, very cool. And that is the path that is least taken. Like I mentioned with Bip Roberts, many former players, they either go into coaching or they go into broadcasting or they go into both, as the case was with Bip. But very few end up going the public education route. But Dave Fleming has. So even though his major league career didn't quite live up to the lofty expectations, he is certainly making a difference nowadays, educating kids and using baseball to help educate them, which I think is excellent. Plus, he's got a little bit of rock star status too. Former major leaguer Dave Fleming could be your child's elementary school teacher if you are living in Connecticut. Now, last but not least, Ben McDonald, or as he's known on his birth certificate, Larry Bernard McDonald, or as we knew him, Big Ben McDonald. Why was he called Big Ben McDonald? Well, 6'7", for one thing, but also very early on in his career, he was the big guy that you called on for those big games, much like, you know, with the Rays for many years, Big James Shields, Big Game James, as they would call him. And he wasn't able to deliver with too many of those with the Rays. He would eventually with the Kansas City Royals. But Big Ben McDonald was a star coming out of high school and going into college. In 1988, boy, did he have a summer here. He won a silver medal with the Baseball World Cup in Rome. He won a gold medal with the U.S. Olympic team in Seoul, Korea. And then he became a pitching stud at LSU. And he was somebody who stood out in 1989 with a 14-4 record, a 3.49 earned run average, and a Southeastern Conference record of 202 strikeouts. He was also part of the All-American team. He won the Golden Spikes Award, and he was just an absolute can't-miss prospect. Well, the Baltimore Orioles, who had a terrible 1988 season, were drafting first overall in 1989. And, of course, Ben McDonald was going to be the guy that a lot of people expected the Orioles to draft first overall. And why not? You know, like I said, here's this guy who's won international tournaments. He's won SEC awards. He was always helping LSU get into a championship position for many, many years. And it seemed like a no-brainer that this big guy could handle the pressure. Well, as it turns out, at the time that the Orioles are doing their work on McDonald, and they do eventually draft him first overall, now they have to sign him. Well, they get into a little bit of a negotiation issue for several reasons. Poor Ben McDonald got kind of caught in the middle of the contract negotiations between his home team, if you will. Basically, his father was leading the negotiations along with super agent Scott Boras. And Boras and McDonald's dad were taking note of another young Orioles pitcher, That would be Greg Olson. Remember Greg Olson, the reliever? Well, he had a solid 1988 season, was doing well in 1989, but was getting paid the league minimum. So McDonald's dad and Boris are just hell-bent on making sure that their prize possession here, the number one overall selection in the draft, isn't just going to, you know, sign to some standard entry-level contract. So they're trying to ratchet up the heat on the Orioles to give McDonald a big signing bonus. And what also plays into the signing of Ben McDonald to the Orioles is somebody who was trying to start an upstart rival professional baseball league. And think too, now this is 1989. This is after the owners are found guilty of colluding to keep free agent prices down. Baseball is in the midst of, you know, some attendance woes. They're having labor negotiation issues at the time. They were negotiating a new collective bargaining agreement. They had just negotiated a new television agreement that switched the TV rights from NBC and ABC over to CBS and ESPN. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of turmoil in Major League Baseball this time. So, of course, when there's uncertainty and turmoil, somebody always thinks of starting up a rival league. Well, who is starting this rival league? None other than Donald Trump. That's right, Donald Trump in 1989 starts concocting this idea of this new independent baseball league, which naturally was going to be changed to the Trump League. And long story short, and this is very typical of Trump sports leagues, if you read Jeff Perlman's book, Football for a Buck, which is about the USFL, the creation of it, the life of it, and the quick demise, which many people will accurately point out was due to Donald Trump. If you read that book, you will see that there is a carbon copy of what Donald Trump did to the USFL to what he did to this idea of the Independent Baseball League. And the old Deadspin website did a great story about this failed baseball league in 2017. So search around for it on the interwebs. It's a pretty interesting story. But like I said, if you read the Jeff Perlman story on the USFL and how Donald Trump tied into the failure of that league, and that is also well documented in the 30 for 30 episode Small Potatoes, which was done a few years ago before Trump became president. And it discusses his interaction with the downfall of the USFL. If you have a little bit of background knowledge of that, and you read the story on Deadspin about how the independent or slash Trump League completely failed even before it even started, you totally get it. You know, this is old news when you read that. But what is interesting is, and it is debatable, did the threat of an independent baseball league or the Trump League, did the threat of it drive up the price for Ben McDonald's contract? Now, many people these days say, no, it really wasn't much of a factor. And again, it's debatable. You know, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But what isn't debatable is that Ben McDonald did get paid. And it is interesting, the timing, after Trump went public in the Washington Post about returning big league baseball to Washington, D.C. through this, you know, new professional league, the day after he signs with the Baltimore Orioles and gets four times what he would have gotten had he been Greg Olson the summer before. So interesting timing and an interesting backstory. And McDonald, even though his career ended a little too early because of injuries, he was part of this resurgent Baltimore Orioles team, which would be a consistent threat to the Yankees, in particular in the American League East, for several years in the mid to late 1990s. Now, he was there in the mid-90s. In fact, he was with the Orioles from 1989 to 95 and would wrap up his career with the Milwaukee Brewers in 1996 and 97. Now, let's back up to Baltimore just a little bit. Part of the starting rotation in 1990, and his first major league start that year through a complete game shutout against the Chicago White Sox, and for the season finished eighth in Rookie of the Year voting. And he would go on to have a relatively successful career there, and was just above 500 in the win-loss record. Pretty good earned run average, especially in the hitter-friendly Camden Yards, which opened up in 1992. But injuries were cutting his career short. He got traded to the Milwaukee Brewers, in 1996 and 1997. and then later traded to the Cleveland Indians in a deal that brought Marquise Grissom and Jeff Judin to Milwaukee in exchange for McDonald, Mike Fetters, and Ron Valone. Now, McDonald never pitched for the Indians. He had rotator cuff surgery in 1998, which was unsuccessful, basically ended his career. And the Brewers, to kind of make up for the deal, would send Mark Watson to Cleveland. So McDonald ends his career 78-70, like I mentioned, 3.91 earned run average and 894 strikeouts. Never pitched in the postseason, which is unfortunate. He was, however, elected to the College Baseball Hall of Fame in 2008. He's been an analyst for the Orioles on MASN, their regional television network, since 2010. He also coaches at Denham Springs High School in Denham Springs. He coaches the softball team, and he still lives in the Louisiana area. He also does occasionally college baseball broadcasts, especially during the NCAA tournament in the spring on ESPN. And there's a great story on him that was written up in The Athletic last year, because it was 30 years since he was drafted by the Orioles. The Orioles, of course, picking first overall in 2019 as well. And there's a little bit of backstory about the Independent League perhaps pumping up his contract in 1989. So anybody who's been the first overall selection since Ben McDonald, you have Ben McDonald and Scott Boras and Ben McDonald's father, and perhaps the blustful promises of Donald Trump and this Independent Baseball League for producing better than normal entry-level contracts for you. So I thought that was a very interesting story, very interesting sub-story to the Ben McDonald story there. Now, it's all part of a very interesting story of the 1993 Topps Series 1. Like I said, it's hard to get some of these packs at reasonable prices because of the Derek Jeter rookie card, and in particular, the gold version of the Derek Jeter card. But if you, again, spend a little time and a little money to obtain those packs, it could be worth your while, simply because it's a great set. A lot of first, a lot of throwback elements in the 1993 set. And I think compared to a lot of the base sets that came out in 1993, you've got a winner for numerous reasons in the top set. So a little more time consuming, a little more money consuming than perhaps collecting the Donruss set from 1993, but certainly well rewarding in the end. You're going to have a hell of a set. And of course, the Jeter rookie as well. Well, that'll wrap up our program for this week. Again, join me in 2 weeks. That will be on Friday, May the 8th. We'll take a look back at the 83 Topps Cello Packs. Don't forget, if you've got a couple extra pennies, you can donate them at paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you don't, that's fine. We're all dealing with some tough economic times now. That's okay. But you can always contribute with your words and your comments, first through rating and reviewing our podcast, but also commenting at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter at any time. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.